Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes naturalist Gabriel Tallent to discuss his debut novel, My Absolute Darling, the story of a young girl's quest for redemption. Wednesday, June 27th at 7 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.
I'm Dan Rodericks of the Baltimore Sun, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 403 for June 25th, 2018, the day before Maryland's primary election. And joining me today to talk about the most interesting races are my colleagues from the Sun staff, Aaron Cox, the Sun's State House Bureau Chief, who's been covering the gubernatorial campaign, Luke Broadwater, who's been covering a little bit of everything, and Pamela Wood, who's been covering the campaigns for Baltimore County Executive. We'll start with Aaron Cox and news from over the weekend about voter registration. Some 18,000 Maryland voters who want to participate in Tuesday's primary will have to cast provisional ballots. Aaron, nice to see you.
Oh, great to be here.
What happened to these 18,000 some odd voters?
Right. So these are folks who tried to change their address or change their party affiliation.
Since the last election?
Since April 2017, using either on the MVA website or on a kiosk. So what happened was in April, there was new software installed. So that when, unless you were buying a product on either at either of those places, say a driver's license or an ID or creating some sort of transaction, your information was not sent to the Board of Elections to update it. So they discovered when an employee of the Board of Elections who had tried to update her address that way discovered that she hadn't got her new card, and she inquired about it, and they looked into it and realized that there was a really, really large population of people over the course of, you know, a little over a year who had also kind of fallen software to what officials are calling a software glitch.
And so it's a very specific glitch.
It's a very specific glitch.
You either
glitch.
Had to use a kiosk at the MVA?
Uh-huh, or go on the MVA's website.
To change your address or party affiliation.
And not have purchased
something from the MVA, like a license or something.
Exactly. Oh. Exactly.
Boy, that is really specific. But that's about 18,000, 300 people? Is that the number?
18,600 people.
600.
18,700.
700,
yes.
Yeah. Okay. So.
And there were more. Who went to go vote early. But because Maryland has same-day registration and party change, you could just fix the problem where you were and then vote. There was a small percentage, roughly around 400 people, who had this happen during
early voting.
Uh-huh. But the balance, the remainder of this population of people, if they show up to the polls, they're not going to be in the poll books.
Okay.
So at their correct precinct.
Right, which means you won't get to do this electronically like everybody else. You have to fill out a ballot.
Right. So provisional ballots came about in Maryland after the 2000 election. Everybody remembers the hanging Chad fiasco from Bush v. Gore in Florida, right?
Right.
So this was a way to enfranchise people that if you show up at the precinct and your information is not right or doesn't appear to be right, you won't be turned away. You can cast a different type of ballot and they'll go validate your registration later and then count it. The hiccup is not just this inconvenience of having to do a different type of ballot. The hiccup is that if you're not at the right precinct, you're not going to get the right ballot. So you may not be able to vote in all of the races. So anywhere you go in Maryland, you're going to be able to vote for governor, right? But say you move from Baltimore to Anne Arundel County. If you show up at your new precinct in Anne Arundel, if you show up at your old precinct in Baltimore, you're going to have you can vote, you know, on that ballot as a vote for
governor.
Well, for governor, which will count.
A statewide office.
But for state's attorney won't count. Mm-hmm. If a congressional district won't count unless you're in the right
in the
precinct.
Same district. Or right. House of Delegates and Senate.
Exactly.
People will mostly show up at their new place, won't they?
Well, if you go and look up your voter lookup, right? If you go and put in your name and your information, it'll tell you your old precinct.
So if you go on the State Board of Elections website to see where am I supposed to go tomorrow
and you put in your
Tuesday.
Information,
yeah.
You'll get the old spot. If you go in there and you put in your new address, it'll tell you you can find for your new address where your new polling location is.
Okay.
And there's also a complication for folks who changed their party, right? Say you didn't move, right? But you're no longer a Republican, you're a Democrat, or vice versa. If you show up and you're even at the right precinct, you'll get a Democratic ballot instead of a Republican ballot. So you'll have to flag that and say.
So if I show up at my new place, they don't know that that's my new place.
No.
I think it's my new place.
Yes.
Will I be allowed to vote in my new place, House of Delegates, Senate, whatever's local?
Yep, and you'll get a ballot. You'll get a paper ballot, and it'll go in an envelope. It'll be marked with your information on the outside, and it'll go in a separate pile, and they will go and look and see Dan Rodericks. This is his address. This is the proper polling precinct. Okay, this one gets counted, and then they'll put that in the pile of getting counted.
The Board of Elections thinks I'm still registered in Baltimore. What if I move to Anne Arundel County? And that's where I show up on Tuesday.
And you tell them, and they say, oh, maybe you're one of these people who have been affected, right? Because there's now an awareness about it.
Right.
And then you'll be given a provisional ballot. Part of the reaction to this was outrage, particularly by the Maryland Democratic Party.
Tell us about that.
Their argument is that this is a basic function of governance. And this was a problem that went undetected for more than a year, and you're discovering it 3 days before an election.
Literally, they only discovered it
Friday.
Friday.
And they, you know, and it took them 24 hours to announce it, too. And the point of how is it possible that something like this could have gone undetected? And who are the people that are being affected by this? Because, you know, their argument is that even though a provisional ballot is counted, it's an extra step at the polls.
Oh, yeah.
It's a confrontation and, a conversation with a poll worker.
Time consuming.
You know, could it have a chilling effect if you show up at what you think is your polling place and the poll worker says you're not registered there, you need to go someplace else. I mean, there's potential here for things to not go smoothly. And so Senator Joan Carter Conway, Baltimore's longtime Democratic senator who chairs the committee that oversees election issues in the Senate, she already has called for a July hearing to look into what went wrong and why didn't they detect this before. And you know, one of the candidates running for governor has said that this is, you know, that this is disenfranchising people. And they kind of raise this idea of maybe perhaps a voter suppression effort by the Hogan administration, who kind of just calls that preposterous and says that there's no conspiracy theory, it's a computer glitch, there's no way we could have targeted anybody in particular
but the
to
glitch,
have become victims
it
of...
It sounds like the glitch was long-lasting.
Yeah, it was for a year.
It started in April 2017
mm-hmm.
and went until last Friday? So the glitch was, as you said, for more than a year. It went from April 2017 until just this past week.
Exactly.
So that does beg the question, how is it that none of that information was coming in, being registered, being logged by the Board of Elections? They didn't notice this gap until last week.
So the MVA, which is a state agency, and has, you know, whose kiosks and website this is, that information was being entered, but it was not being transmitted to the Board of Elections to be able to update or use anything. So the Board of Elections didn't realize that there was information that was not being sent to them.
How would they know that?
How do you know a negative, right? Yeah. How do you know that you're missing out on something until somebody says, hey, this isn't working?
Yeah.
And the MVA, over the course of more than a year, that's, you know, 1,000 people a month, 1,500 people a month. It's not a gigantic compared to the number of people that interact with the MVA, you know, on a regular basis. It's not a huge percentage. So no one had brought this up. It was, and it's still not clear whose software this is, whose glitch this is, if the culpability is on the Board of Elections, if the culpability is on MVA, if it's on both.
Who was supposed to have their eye on it?
Right, and whose software was this that kind of failed to do this very fundamental thing?
Mm-hmm. And when I say whose eye was supposed to be on it, even though it is software that's supposed to do what it's supposed to do, there needs to be a human eye on it to say, this information is not going to the Board of Elections.
Exactly.
You would think. Okay, so that's gonna be a bit time consuming for people on Election Day who show up for the primary. What are we expecting in this primary? I noticed that the pundits said that you can't read too much into early voting in terms of voter enthusiasm, but there was a lot of voter enthusiasm during that 1 week of early voting from June 14th to June 21st.
Right. So in, over the course of 7 days, you had 54% more people go vote early than they did 4 years ago. And the question is, are those people who were going to vote anyway now just taking care of the convenience of voting early? As you know, early voting is new. It tends to ramp up year after year after year, and more mm-hmm. people choose it as an option. Or is this a reflection of people really wanting to come out and vote? Is this the blue wave that we've been hearing about predicted? Is this Trump-activated activism and engagement, that kind of the complacency that a lot of people had before his election is now shattered? Are we now seeing so many more people come out and vote? And it's really hard to tell.
Yeah.
And early voting is not always predictive either.
Remember, four years ago. We've been warned that you can't detect too much you can't read too much into this. Right.
Right. So, like 4 years ago, for instance, on election night, when the early voting results came back, Anthony Brown had it in a landslide. And we all know how that turned out.
Yeah. He lost to Larry Hogan, the incumbent, who is running for re-election, of course, the Republican governor of Maryland, who got quite a hit on NPR on Monday. I don't know if you heard Morning Edition. There was a very flattering story about how popular Larry Hogan is and how mixed up the Democrats are. What mixed up? They've had a very competitive primary. I mean, I don't think it's a bad thing. There's some people tend to look at the Democratic field and say, well, it's a big mess. There's too many candidates. Too many people are undecided because it's hard to figure out who's who and what's what. And people haven't really been paying attention. But it's been a pretty robust few months here for the Democrats.
Well, I mean, these are all very credible, capable people. It's not that we have a field of seven people that voters look at and say, shrug.
Right.
I mean, they do have a lot of policy overlap, but when it comes to identity and biography, style, how they would match up against Larry Hogan, you have seven very distinct choices.
Hey, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
The polls indicate a lot of undecideds. I mean, a big number, like 22% more?
44%.
Was it that? Oh, it was double.
Just 2 weeks ago, it was 44%.
Yeah. In what poll was that? Gonzalez?
That was us.
That was the Sun poll. Okay.
Yes. Baltimore Sun, University of Baltimore.
Thank you. That's right. And then there's the Goucher poll. But anyway, where do you put that? A big undecided number among Democrats, and yet the Democrats came out 3-1 over Republicans in early voting. You match up those two things? All those people made up their mind, or they went out early and said, God damn it, I need to make up my mind, so I'm going to go vote early and force myself to vote. I don't know. What do you think?
There's a couple different ways you can read that. And I mean, I think we're kind of getting into territory where we're like tea leaf reading, right?
Yeah.
Like, we'll find out what it meant.
You get a chance to speculate a little
yes.
bit. That's podcasting.
Exactly. So, I mean, it could be the case that those people who are showing up showed up to vote for state's attorney in the city,
in
showed
Baltimore.
Up to vote for county executive in Prince George's County, showed up to vote for very competitive county council, county executive races in Montgomery, or the competitive...
In Baltimore County, too.
In Baltimore County. So it's not that we're not sure if all those people came because they were really racing to the polls to pick somebody to face Larry Hogan in the fall. And the candidates will tell you. I talked to Rashern Baker, my colleague Mike Dresser, talked to Alec Ross. Both of them were stunned that, you know, they're out at early voting centers meeting people who are saying, yeah, I still haven't decided who I'm voting for governor.
And they're candidates
right.
for governor.
And they're candidates. Yeah, they're saying this to the candidate's face as they are walking into the polls. They're still kind of trying to figure out who they want to go
with.
Well,
I've asked people I know who are Democrats, who are you voting for? And I get a real mixture there. I get, like, I'm not really sure yet. And it's 2 days before the election.
Well, for example, I went to a forum in late April or early May, where, you know, there were nine candidates. They each took, you know, two and a half minutes to introduce themselves. It took 20 minutes just to evaluate basic information about who these people are. I mean,
right.
It is a tall task to be able to distinguish who each of these individual people are,
mm-hmm.
what you like about them, what's important to you. You know, it's almost like you need some sort of like online quiz where you click your preferences and something spits out a candidate for you, right? Because the amount of time that you have to invest to figure out who is this person, what do they stand for? I mean, and even the shorthand that we use a lot, like that Ben Jealous is a darling of progressive and labor unions, that Rashern Baker has establishment support, that
that he's a competent county executive, right?
Exactly. Like all of these are also very truncated shorthands for complex people with nuanced policy. You know, you're really, it's really a challenging thing. I mean, I have trouble picking an ice cream flavor when I have seven choices.
That's why the television advertising is so important, I would think.
Right, because a lot of, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of this is people, a lot of casual voters are people who don't, you know, are busy people. They care about politics, but they're not junkies. They're not going to read all 187 stories that the Baltimore Sun's political team has written about this. They're going to start paying attention a couple days before they poll. Something is going to resonate with them, whether it's an issue or a personal story or the way that somebody presents himself or herself to the public. Mm-hmm. And that's how they're going to vote. I mean, that's how a lot of people interact with the democratic system. And that makes a seven candidate race kind of really tricky. I mean, the media can't focus on one or two candidates to really elevate or probe or kind of draw out some of these distinctions, because it's not fair to focus on two people when it's, you know, six or seven people in the race.
Right.
I mean, one of the things that the polling that came out did was kind of focus the media's attention on Ben Jealous and Rashern Baker, who were the front runners with you know, the people behind them had like a third of the support. And it would have been unusual for somebody to catch fire and catch them, but they still could, right? Like, just because we say it's mainly a two-man race who represent, you know, kind of the Bernie Sanders wing and the Hillary Clinton wing, which is an easy way to simplify, that doesn't really mean that's actually what the race is. I mean,
right.
People like Krish.
And with so many undecided.
Right.
Yeah, like, oh, yeah, Krish Vignaraja. Yeah.
Right, for instance, she's the only woman
Shea.
In the race.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll take Krish as an example, because she's the only woman.
And she's running with a woman, a female running mate.
She's running with a woman. She's an immigrant. She is extremely charismatic and engaging.
Very smart.
Very smart. She only started airing TV ads a week ago. And, you know, she talks about how she feels like she has a really high conversion rate when she meets a voter, when she interacts, when people hear her, they're like, oh, I'm in for her. Is it possible that she moves from polling at 4% to taking away the thing? It's mathematically possible.
Mm-hmm.
With voters who aren't paying attention and only started thinking about their choices in the last week, maybe.
And so many undecided.
Right.
And if there is that enthusiasm there because of a local race, not just the gubernatorial, people will be in the polling booth who, for a specific reason, state's attorney, like you say, or county executive race, or a congressional race, and they'll have to vote for a governor, a candidate.
Right.
Well, they won't have to, but it'll be right there in front of them.
Right, and it's hard to abdicate that responsibility, right? Like, if you have made a choice to come take time out of your day to go vote, look at the top of the ticket, it's hard to just leave it blank.
Yeah.
Unless you really, really are conflicted about your choices. So, I mean, I think most people put their money on either Baker or Jealous coming out as the winner on Tuesday night. But it is not outside the realm of possibility that any of these other candidates could have found something that really catapulted them.
And on the Republican side, you think Larry Hogan would have the nomination?
Larry Hogan is planning a victory party.
Is anyone running against Larry Hogan?
No, no.
There's not a single, like,
Arguably the entire Democratic field is.
Yeah, no, but I mean, a Republican, he has no Republican challenger. The primary.
No, he doesn't even have like a nominal Republican primary challenger. It's Larry Hogan versus blank
space.
Like some
eccentric man or woman, Frederick County, decided to run. No?
No, no, okay. It's just Larry Hogan. But he's nonetheless holding a victory party.
Yeah. The one thing about this as we go into it is Kevin Kamenetz. I kept thinking about him. He was sitting in the chair you're sitting in just a week before he died. And you know, it's so weird. It's still shocking to me to think about the loss of Kevin Kamenetz in the midst of this campaign. And that's the question. A friend of his wrote to me over the weekend an email saying, of course, we think he would have won on Tuesday night, so that's looming for all of us to think about. And it's there. It's still there.
He's on the ballot.
Something we'll never know. And he's on the ballot.
I mean, it's physically there.
Yeah. I just want to ask you one thing about the woman he was running with, Valerie Ervin. Much has been made about a feud that she's having with Ben Jealous. What is going on there? Do you understand what that's about?
Well, so Valerie Ervin is someone who's been in the middle of progressive politics in Maryland for a long time. And Ben Jealous is somebody who was really much more of a national figure than a Maryland figure. Mm-hmm. I mean, he led some really important efforts in Maryland. Our newspaper recognized him as Marylander of the Year for his work kind of organizing people for ballot initiatives when laws passed by the Dream Act and gay marriage were on the ballot. But she's kind of been a long time in Maryland operating in this orbit, and Ben Jealous is a relative newcomer in some senses to that field. And her experience with Ben Jealous, from her perspective, is that she thinks the way that he conducts himself in private is dishonorable, and she wants everybody to know about it before the election comes. Ben Jealous, on the other hand.
But what specifically is that? This has to do with a job that she had.
Yeah, her broader contention is that when given the opportunity to bully her and tried, he has taken it. She was working for Maryland Working Families and was considering joining the candidates ticket. And, running for lieutenant governor is incompatible with running a political organization that supports your opponent. Like, they're just incompatible jobs.
So Maryland Working Families supported Ben Jealous.
Right. And so she very well couldn't both run the political organization trying to get Ben Jealous elected while at the same time running against him on the ticket of somebody else. And so that's kind of a binary choice. You can't do both. Valerie says that when this started coming up, Ben Jealous was putting pressure on working families to just fire her, kick her out, not create a leave of absence. That her exit was not done on her terms, and that's Ben Jealous's fault.
This is what she alleges.
This is what she alleges.
And he denies that?
Vehemently.
Okay.
Yeah, who Kevin Kamenetz was running with is not a big enough issue for him to have bothered weighing in for this. He doesn't have a problem with Valerie. He doesn't really understand why she has a problem with him. But he's also at the same time, and his staff at the same time, are using language that isn't complimentary. You know, that this shows that they've kind of had enough of her going out there and taking swipes at him and questioning his character and implying that he bullies women. They just have no patience for that.
This aside, it doesn't seem to me that whoever the Democratic candidate is who wins on Tuesday, who emerges as the party's nominee, is going to be looking at a scorched earth. That most of these candidates have gotten along fine. They agree on most of the issues. And I saw a movement that had started in Maryland to get them all to agree to support whoever the winner is.
Right. And Kathleen Matthews told me a couple of weeks ago that all of them have already agreed to appear at a unity rally Wednesday, the day after the election, in Annapolis, saying we're all for whoever wins, and that agreement was made well in advance of any votes being cast.
And that's from the chairwoman of the Democratic Party in Maryland.
Yes.
All right, Aaron. Well, thank you very much. I'll talk to you on Wednesday after we find out who wins.
All right. Can't wait for it.
And joining us next is Sun reporter Luke Broadwater. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Quinn Kelly, and I host a weekly podcast for the Baltimore Sun called Female Trouble. Each Tuesday, we feature a new long-form conversation with one of the area's most interesting and accomplished women, from public officials and congresswomen to rappers and restaurant owners. You can find Female Trouble on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Find more info at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble.
Luke Broadwater with us now. Luke, nice to see you.
Good afternoon, Dan.
So you've been gallivanting. You've been doing all kinds of reporting on this election. You did a couple of profiles of gubernatorial candidates on the Democratic side, and then you went out to early voting places over the last week. Let's talk about that for a minute. Lots of enthusiasm. You remember The Untouchables with Robert De Niro as Al Capone? Enthusiasm, that's what he said. But it seems like there's a lot of enthusiasm, but of course, political analysts that you quote say, don't make too much of that because in past elections, early voting has not been an indicator of an outcome and not an indicator of growth in total votes.
Right, that's right.
Not been a predictor of that.
Sure. Nevertheless, we have we ended with a 56% increase in early voting compared to 4 years ago. One of the things that I noticed working with voters is it wasn't necessarily the governor's race that was driving them to the polls. A lot of them were interested in down ballot races.
Yeah, that's what Aaron was speculating about. Like the state's attorney's race in Baltimore City, for instance, probably has got a lot of people interested.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, no, I met people who came specifically to vote for Marilyn Mosby at the polls in West Baltimore. They I might have also voted for Ben Jealous or might have also voted for Elijah Cummings, but I'm here to vote for Marilyn Mosby.
And was it organized? Can you sense at an early polling place that a specific candidate has a get-out-the-vote effort? Is that something you could tell?
You could. That wasn't my experience. I do know on Sunday there was a Souls for the Polls drive from the churches, and that was very much centered in a pro-Marilyn Mosby way. And so they did take people from the churches to the polls, and a lot of those were Marilyn Mosby supporters.
Let's talk about the state's attorney's race. Very interesting, I think. Marilyn Mosby, the incumbent, who 4 years ago unseated the incumbent Greg Bernstein, blaming him for a rise in violent crime. Of course, since Marilyn Mosby became state's attorney, there's been even more violence in the city, a higher rate of homicides. Anyway, and she has two very credible challengers this year, Thirroo Vigneraja, who had been a deputy state's attorney and then went off to the attorney general's office, and Ivan Bates, a veteran prosecutor. Well, he spent time in the prosecutor's office and then became a criminal defense attorney, actually defended one of the police officers in the Freddie Gray trials. And he spent some money on advertising. It seems to me Bates has got a lot of presence on television. I haven't seen as much from Mosby.
No, he went up first on TV, and he's been up longer, and he's been up heavier. He's actually led the way in fundraising, so he has the most money to spend. Just in the newsroom, I was glancing at the TV, and I saw Bates and Mosby ads back to back. So Marilyn Mosby is up now also. I haven't seen I saw one Thirroo Vigneraja ads.
Yeah,
but that
was only recently. Within the last 4 or 5 days.
Yes, and this is. This is a very competitive field, and it's been a very lively race in a way perhaps the governor's race has not been. If you watched our debate that we had at the University of Baltimore,
it's very good, yeah.
That was fire.
Yeah.
I mean, it was attacks on each other. People took things very personally. There felt like there were real stakes in the race.
Yes.
You have out of control violent crime, 3 years of terrible homicide rate. You've got police abuse of citizens, the Department of Justice. There seems to be such high stakes in that race, and you could really feel the passion out of all three candidates in a way perhaps that the Democratic primary for governor is missing.
I would say one thing is sort of a logistical thing. You had only three candidates for state's attorney, you have six or seven for governor, and even a couple more added for one of those television debates. So there were like 8 or 9 people.
Yeah, no, I know.
And they have to introduce themselves, and it took up all this time, whereas the state's attorney's debate, you got right into it.
Right.
Brief introductions, and then pow.
And you can't even this is the whole enchilada, right? One of these three people is going to win. In the governor's race, it's still a fight to see which Democrat gets to face Larry Hogan. Then you might see more differences and more fire in the race. Rather than am I a better candidate to face Larry than this guy or that mm-hmm. or that lady? it's a very exciting race, and I think people are really interested and into it. And if you watch the news coverage and watch social media at all, there seems to be a ton more passion into that race with supporters for and against people.
Well, it's understandable in the state's attorney because of the violence we've seen in the city,
right?
Because of the Freddie Gray case, Marilyn Mosby. I heard when she campaigns, she says things like, don't forget me, I stood up for you.
That's right.
Meaning, I indicted cops when others wouldn't. I charged cops in connection with Freddie Gray's death. I didn't get any convictions, but at least I did that much. So
right.
there are lots of people in Baltimore who will give her credit for that. And then there's others who are so terribly concerned about the rate of violence. And remember that she hung some of the blame for the increase in violence on the predecessor she unseated.
That's right.
I mean, she really hammered Bernstein on that.
No, I remember her campaign. The rhetoric was all about Greg Bernstein is the one person who's failing the city of Baltimore. The police are doing their job. The mayor is doing her job.
The judges are doing their job, I
right,
think she said.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And then 4 years later, her campaign speeches have been much more about his crime as a holistic matter. And we need to tack things about like learning and literacy and rehabilitation. and things that the mayor is trying to do also. But so you can obviously see when you are a challenger running against someone who has a record, you can have one tactic, and when you're in the incumbent and you have to own the record, you have to use a different strategy.
Someone wrote to me shortly after a column I wrote on the state's attorney's race that Mosby has cover in that the police department has been under siege in so many different ways, right? Either under the consent decree from the Justice Department, from general criticism from the citizens in the aftermath of the Freddie Gray case, or from the gun trace task force corruption, and all the cases that had to be thrown out that involved any of the officers from that corrupt unit. So she has some cover there when you start talking about conviction rate, her ability to get convictions of repeat violent offenders. It's been poisoned a bit by the problems with the police department, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that the public perception of the Baltimore Police Department has to be at a historic low with the consent decree, the gun trace task force scandal. I mean, it seems like and then just sort of daily, more minor things. I mean, this cop here gets in trouble for something, or that commander there is accused of wrongdoing. I think the real issue will be whether the average Baltimore voter believes the state's attorney is responsible for the crime rate. I think most people look at the mayor and the police chief for that. And I'm not sure if that's actually logical or reasonable that they do mm-hmm. that, but they mm-hmm. it seems like Pew gets blamed or held responsible for crime, and maybe whoever the police commissioner is.
Right.
But the state's attorney, to make that connection for the voters, is that's the real challenge for Ivan Bates and Tharuth Vigniraja. If they can convince people that the state's attorney owns that murder rate, well, now you have a very compelling argument for a change. But if most people look at that, well, she's like an umpire calling balls and strikes.
Or you like my metaphor? Well, remember my metaphor? I want to give myself credit for the metaphor. It's like blaming the chief of surgery for the heart disease
in
the community.
Yeah, there you go.
The chief cardiac surgeon for the heart disease.
Right.
But I thought about it, and I thought, okay, if the chief cardiac surgeon does his job or her job and fixes people's hearts and their valves and all that stuff, then there will be a reduction in heart disease or deaths from heart ailments, right?
Yeah.
So that's the argument Bates and Vigniraja had to make. If the state's attorney does her job and puts away repeat violent offenders and gets lengthy sentences and we don't see them again, you'll see a drop in violent crime.
Yeah, I think Tharuth even uses a football analogy, that the state's attorney is the quarterback of the crime fight, and that's the person that can really design the plays and launch the complex investigations and put away the baddest of the bad for a long period of time and really bring down
the murder rate. My metaphor is better. I'm sorry.
it's a fundamental question in the race and how the voters decide it will.
I think
could perhaps.
Have we seen any polling on this? It seems to me it's the incumbents' race to lose, right?
Unfortunately, we did not poll that race. We did the governor and Baltimore County executive. Polls are expensive, and we can't poll everything. We have seen internal polls from the Mosby camp and also the Vigniraja camp. We don't usually quote or lend credence to candidates' polls because they're often – we don't know how they're worded, and it's perhaps they're worded in a way to favor a candidate.
I almost don't read them when I see them
I mean, for what they're worth, Mosby's poll showed her up big, and Vignaraja's poll showed him doing very well.
Doing better than Bates.
Yes,
of course.
Yeah, so okay. –
Luke, I was just wondering, looking around the city and the counties, any races you want to talk about, draw attention to?
Sure. In addition to the state's attorney, we have – four really interesting competitive Senate races in Baltimore City, and we have a really interesting delegates race in Southeast Baltimore in the 46th District. There is perhaps a theme to the Senate races, and that is younger, less experienced candidates taking on older, much better established candidates. And we see that in East Baltimore, where Corey McCray, the state delegate, is taking on State Senator Nathaniel McFadden, who's been there forever, is Speaker pro tem of the Senate. We see a similar dynamic in District 43, where Joan Carter Conway is the head of chairwoman of. You're raising your hand, Dan.
I was going to tell
you. Go ahead.
I have never seen so many mailers in my life. I'm in their district. I'm in Joan Carter Conway's district. Mary Washington is challenging her. There's been I mean, I could insulate my house with the amount of mailers I've seen from those two. I mean, every day, and sometimes two or three a day.
Yes.
Right. It's very competitive.
Yeah, very much so.
Delegate Mary Washington challenging longtime State Senator Joan Carter Conway.
That's right. And I think that's going to be a really competitive race. Joan Carter Conway is perhaps arguably one of the most powerful politicians in the state of Maryland. She has a long record of passing a lot of bills. She certainly has a lot of things she can point to. At the same time, Delegate Mary Washington is a very formidable challenger and has more individual donations from the community than Senator Conway has, and perhaps that's an indication that she has more rank-and-file support. Moving over to the 40th district, we have Antonio Hayes, the delegate, taking on Senator Barbara Robinson. That's another, again, a younger delegate moving up to try to challenge a older state senator. And then in the 41st, we have J.D. Merrill, a newcomer to politics, taking on Senator Jill P. Carter, who is obviously closely aligned with Mayor Catherine Pugh and was her civil rights director.
So one thing about that, of course, Merrill, J.D. Merrill, is the son-in-law of former mayor and governor Martin O'Malley.
Correct.
And Jill Carter only recently became state senator by appointment.
That's right.
The governor appointed her to fill a spot left by...
Left by... Nathaniel Oakes.
I was going to give you the pleasure of
mentioning Nathaniel Oakes, who had been obviously convicted of corruption and is probably going to be...
For the second time.
Yes.
I was around the first time he got into trouble, and then he made a political comeback, and then, as you say, he got in more trouble this past year.
Interestingly enough, he just re-registered to vote, which means that potentially he could serve if by some fluke he won. His name is still on the ballot. And that adds a whole monkey wrench in that race.
Boy.
And then down in the 46th, we have
another race?
Yeah, we have a good race in the delegates race. We have the ticket Team 46, which is Delegate Brooke Learman, Delegate Luke Clippinger, and Delegate Robin Lewis. And they are facing two pretty spirited challengers, Nate Lowenthal and Dia Thomas. And Nate Lowenthal in particular has raised a tremendous amount of money.
That's pronounced Lowenthal.
Lowenthal.
He was here on the show because he's heading up Baltimore Homecoming.
Yes, that's right. You've had him on.
Yes. And I believe it was Lowenthal.
Lowenthal.
T-H-I-E-L.
Thank you.
Okay. So he's running for delegate.
Correct.
And who's the other one?
Dia Thomas.
Oh, yeah, Dia Thomas.
Who is a promising candidate who came in second to Eric Costello in the city council.
These are all these people I interviewed when they were running for city council. And they're very impressive people.
We have a lot of really good candidates this year.
Yeah.
And so and I think that's what's frustrating to some people down in the 46th is they say, well, we have all these good people here. Why didn't more people run against Oaks or something? That's the way it is. And he has raised, I think, over $400,000 to run for delegate.
Lowenthal?
Yeah, which is, I think more than some of the governor candidates have. So that's going to be a very interesting race to watch, too. So there you have it. Like, all of Baltimore City is in play this year. We have really spirited races all across the city, including state's attorney.
And one thing I'll mention is for Congress, because I've been keeping an eye on the first district. I don't know. I just think it's interesting that you have an incumbent Republican who's very conservative, Andy Harris, who has won easily over there since getting elected in 2010. But seems to be a lot more interest in the Democratic candidates this year than in previous years. And, of course, you're always looking to see, is there a blue wave? Could it happen in that district, which tilts very heavily toward the red, toward Republican? So, anyway, you have several good candidates running for, well, three anyway. I don't know about the rest of them, but the three that I've interviewed, they're all impressive in their own way, running for the Democratic nomination to challenge Harris. So that's the other thing I would say keep an eye on. And there's another congressional race that's interesting to fill the seat being vacated by John Delaney in the 6th District.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
Thank you, Luke.
Great. Thank you.
We'll be right back with the Sun's Pamela Wood to talk about the Baltimore County executive campaigns.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, More information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.
Now, another local election, this one of keen interest to our readers in Baltimore County, the county executive campaigns for the Democratic and Republican nominations. Here's Sun reporter Pamela Wood. Pamela, nice to see you.
Thanks for having me.
You and Allison Kay have been doing a great job on this campaign. I would say this might be the most comprehensive coverage I've seen of a county executive's race. Of course, it's one of the most interesting ones.
That's right. We have competitive primaries in both parties, three Democrats and two Republicans running. It's an open seat. So there's a lot of competition both ways, and all those five leading candidates are making a lot of news and keeping us quite busy.
Again, the name of Kevin Kamenetz here in this segment of the show because he was the county executive for two terms.
That's right. Kevin Kamenetz died suddenly, May 10th, cardiac arrest, and he was term limited, and he was finishing his second of two terms and was among the leading contenders for governor. And Don Mohler is filling the rest of his term, but he's not running for anything. So it's an open seat, and that's why we've drawn so much interest.
Let's talk about the Democratic candidates. Now, Kevin Kamenetz was a member of the county council when he ran for county executive, and so is Vicki Almond.
That's right. Vicki Almond is a county councilwoman. She represents the same district that Kevin Kamenetz did. Mm-hmm. So sort of potentially she would be following in his footsteps, the same path representing northwestern Baltimore County and now trying for county executive. And if she were to be elected, she would be the first woman elected Baltimore County executive. It's been all men for all time in Baltimore County.
Would there have been like 13 of them? 13 county executives? I think I saw that somewhere on the county website.
13, yes. Yeah. 13, all men. All white men.
Okay. Jim Brochin, a state senator, is running for this seat, as is a former state delegate, John Olszewski, Johnny O.
State Senator Jim Brochin represents kind of the north central part of the county. He's been four terms, I believe, in the state Senate, kind of an independent-minded senator. And then you have
a Democrat who votes which way, you never know for sure. Some people say sometimes he's a Democrat, sometimes he votes Republican.
Right? He's not one to who hews to the party line or party orders, if you will. But he is promoting in his literature that he is a real Democrat, the real Democrat in the race.
Whereas Vicki Almond says he's not a real Democrat, right? That's one of her criticisms of him.
Right. Yes. Yeah, she has been hammering him on some of his past votes on health care, sick leave, and his mixed record on gun control.
And then there's Johnny O, John Olszewski, a former state delegate.
Right. And now this is Johnny Olszewski Jr. His father, John Olszewski Sr., was also in politics.
Right.
He served on the county council representing the Dundalk area. This is Johnny Jr. He was a state delegate. He got swept out in the Larry Hogan wave of 4 years ago. He was trying to move up to the state Senate, and the Dundalk area just totally flipped Republican. So he's now trying to have a comeback of sorts and trying to go countywide as county executive. And he is positioning himself as a more progressive vision for the county.
One of the most interesting stories you had was just in the last week on gun control. Now, you would expect gun control to come up in a governor's race, certainly a U.S. Senate or congressional race, because gun laws are promulgated at that level. Not so much at the local level, although there's some. But anyway, how has this played out? Explain this one to us.
Right. If you had asked me 6 months ago to predict the key issues in the Baltimore County executive's race, gun control would not have been one of them.
Yeah, I would say the tax rate or development in the county, maybe the schools, the school
right.
construction, something like that, right?
Yeah,
not,
yeah,
not
absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Schools, public safety, police.
Yeah. Crime.
Yeah, that sort of thing. So I tried to kind of figure out why we're talking about gun control in this race. And some of the experts I talked to pointed out that this is a national conversation ever since, you know, mass shooting after mass shooting after mass shooting. And things kicked up a notch after the shooting in Parkland, Florida, and those children became so active. And it's an issue that everybody's talking about and driving some more interest into politics. However, the Baltimore County Executive has no official say really over gun control. State law prohibits counties from doing almost anything on gun control, just very narrow realm. Now, certainly a county executive could be a sort of a public face and have some influence, but this is not what county government does. County government plows your streets and collects your trash and takes care of your waste.
But two of the candidates served in the state legislature where it is an issue, and that would be Olszewski and Brochin.
Right, and that's where the attacks against both of them are coming from. In 2013, after the shooting at Sandy Hook, Maryland passed a law banning many assault weapons in the state, and Olszewski voted against it, and he's taken a lot of flack for that, for voting against it. Now, he has since said, you know what, that was a mistake. Now, I'm not sure he thought about that at the time, and I'm not sure his constituents were upset with that vote at the time, but now he's positioning himself as progressive. He says, I've learned, you know, I, going forward, want common sense gun laws. Now, with Senator Brochin, it's a little more complicated because he did vote for the assault weapons ban, and he has voted for other gun control bills, but gun control advocates point out that he's made a lot of procedural votes that are more aligned with the gun rights lobby in terms of amendments he supported that would have weakened bills. And at one point on the assault weapons ban, the opponents of it were trying to basically filibuster it. They were trying to talk it dead. And there was a motion to end debate and take the vote. And he voted against ending debate. He wanted to keep debate going, which gun control, gun violence prevention advocates say that that was a more important vote. Mm-hmm. So he's found himself defending his record on that. And there's this back and forth.
So Vicky Ahmed, is she the one pushing this?
Yeah, a lot of this is coming from Vicky Allman's camp. Also from, there's a slate that supports her that's controlled by former county executive Jim Smith, who's now a top aide to Mayor Pugh in the city. He's got this hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign money that he can direct to candidates on a list that he likes. And Jim Smith's slate has been doing a lot of mailers against Brochin on this topic.
Let's talk about money a little bit. What's the money picture look like among these three Democrats?
All three Democrats have raised a significant amount of money and spent a significant amount of money. And going into the final weeks, they're all on TV. Some are on radio. They've been doing flyers. And so they had enough money to keep it going. Senator Brochin actually only had about $36,000 on hand in the final weeks because he's spent most of it already. He went heavier and did a larger buy on TV earlier than the others.
And signs, I would say. I've saw a lot of big Brochin signs around the county.
Right. If you drive up and down York Road, it's Brochin signs the whole way.
Let's go over to the Republican side where you have another state delegate, Patrick McDonough, running against the Maryland State Insurance Commissioner, Al Redmer, who I think also served in the legislature at some point too, right?
That's right. And you could not get two more different candidates who are in the same party than Al Redmer and Pat McDonough. Al Redmer is a former state delegate. He's now on his second go-around as the insurance commissioner for the state, appointed by Governor Larry Hogan. He also had that job under Governor Bob Ehrlich. And he is Hogan's pick. Hogan supported. Hogan did a rally with Redmer the other day. He represents the centrist, business-friendly, efficiency in government type of Republican. And then you have Delegate McDonough, who is known for being quite vocal, espousing very conservative, populist positions. He's not afraid to speak his mind, and some of his policies are rather controversial. He promises to make English the official language of Baltimore County. He will stop any county assistance to the city, even, you know, grants to help the zoo. He'll put an end to that. He wants to end Section 8 housing. It's he has a very dark view of the county that he needs to, you know, save the county and turn things around.
He also has a long record of opposing anything that at all would benefit immigrants.
That's right. He was involved. He's been involved somewhat in the case of a community in Harford County, because although he lives in Baltimore County, his current district is Baltimore and Harford County over a housing development there that has some ties to a Muslim organization. And there's been a lot of very inflammatory rhetoric from a lot of folks up there. And he's been in the middle of it.
Yeah. And we just had a federal judge's ruling on Friday saying that the Harford County erred in not issuing permits for the housing development in question, and cited the rhetoric in the community, anti-Muslim rhetoric. I think the judge used the word vile animus toward a religious group. Mm-hmm. And Patrick McDonough was involved in that. He was involved in opposition to any recognition of the Dreamers in Maryland. So he has a long, very very strong conservative, deeply conservative, Trumpian, you might even say, record.
Yes, and actually he says, you know, at times he has embraced this idea that he is the Trump of Baltimore County, but more lately he says, well, I won't be like Don Trump, I'll be like Don Schaefer, William Donald Schaefer, if I'm elected. So he goes back and forth on whether he embraces that or not. But certainly I think...
Excuse me, that's just a reference to a former Baltimore mayor and governor who was a do-it-now kind of Democrat, who I don't remember having the kind of track record Pat McDonough has. But anyway, that's Dan's comment. Sorry, Pamela.
No, it's okay. He he does embrace that do-it-now. He wants to be a man of action, as Schaefer was. But I think what's interesting in this race is maybe this will tell us, what do Republicans want out of their party? Do they want a Trump-style
politician?
Yeah, right. Or do they,
representative? Yeah,
right. Or do they want a Hogan-style, you know, centrist, pragmatic politician? And maybe we'll see where the Republican Party is heading.
This is a place where you could see it in Baltimore County, Northern Baltimore County, and the county executive race, because there is a question. The way Larry Hogan, the incumbent governor, has distanced himself from Trump, that makes him popular with a lot of Democrats. It may make him less popular with some Republicans who think the governor went too far in distancing himself from Donald Trump. So we'll see about that.
Yeah, all you have to do is look at the governor's Facebook page. Whenever he makes one of these, like, very calculated, he walks that line, very calculated decisions about opposing something Trump did. And he's always careful on how he phrases things, but he will get blasted in the comments. So now those Republican voters, are they ever going to vote for a Democrat for governor? Probably not, but
they
may
not
stay.
Vote. Yeah.
Yes, they may stay home. Right. And in Baltimore County in particular, looking ahead to the general, if Governor Hogan wants to win re-election, he needs Baltimore County to come out for him, you know, Republicans and persuadable Democrats. So we could see a lot in this primary that could inform what the general election looks like.
Pamela Wood mentioned before that Vicki Ammon, running for county executive, is giving up a seat on the Baltimore County Council. So I just wanted to get from you a couple of council seats to watch, council races to watch on Tuesday.
Right. The county council races haven't gotten quite as much attention, but there are a handful with contested primaries. Vicki Ammon in the northwest part, she opens up a seat. It's a pretty heavily Democratic area. There's three Democrats running. Izzy Patoka, who is a planner by trade. He used to work for O'Malley. Rick Yaffe owns a private ambulance company. And a third man, Harlan Zinn, who is a life coach. And a therapist. So they're vying for a chance in the Democratic primary, have a good chance in the general, whoever wins that. In Northern Baltimore County, Wade Catch is the councilman incumbent, Republican, and he's getting primaried by two challengers. And that's a district that's not shy about booting people out if they don't like what they do. So that bears watching. And then over in the northeast part of the county, County Councilwoman Kathy Bevins, a Democrat, is unopposed in her primary, but there's a whole slew of Republicans in the GOP primary that they're lining up for a shot against her. This is an area that the Republican Party is targeting to try and get some gains.
Yeah, and they had some gains in 2014.
Yeah, on the east side, the southeast side, you know, the Dundalk, Sparrows Point area, and the Republican Party is hoping to move it up to
Rosedale.
Yes, Rosedale, Essex, Middle River, White Marsh.
I get you, Pamela. Well, thank you very much for that preview.
Oh, thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
That's Sun reporter Pamela Wood. That's our show for now. Make sure you read The Sun and BaltimoreSun.com for complete coverage of Tuesday's primary. We'll be back with another episode of Roughly Speaking on Wednesday, and we'll talk about the results of the election. For producer Quinn Kelly in the Baltimore Sun Newsroom, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.